This week on Lunchbox Envy, it's added to three quarters of the packaged food in the supermarket.
In the 17th century, the governor of Barbados was paid in it.
And you can sprinkle it over bees to treat them for mites.
It's sugar! Hello and welcome to Lunchbox Envy. I'm Alex and I'm here with my fellow QI elves, Manu and Jack.
It's a very sweet, sweet day for us.
A big topic. This will be part one. We're going to do the history and the culture and the science and definitely do a more culinary part two with Rosie and maybe another chef.
That'd be lovely. I realised I didn't really know what sugar was.
No? I've heard of like monosaccharides and complex sugars and natural sugars and polysaccharides. Like how does it work?
So basically sugar is made up of carbon, oxygen and hydrogen in different forms. So basically you start with the monosaccharides. So these are single molecules. We are going to oversimplify this, but if you imagine your basic Lego blocks are glucose, fructose and galactose. Mm-hmm. So they are three flavors of monosaccharide. So they're all pretty much the same molecule, but with slight tweaks. And glucose is the one that we absolutely love as humans because it's the main way we get our energy. So,
it's people petrol.
Yeah. It's basically people petrol. So. We all, and you get glucose from all the carbohydrates you eat. When you add two of them together, they make a double Lego block, which is known as a disaccharide. Mm. The three main ones are sucrose, lactose, and maltose.
Ooh.
So you notice they all end in O's. Sucrose is glucose added to a fructose. Mm-hmm. Lactose is a galactose added to a glucose.
Uh-huh.
And maltose is a double glucose.
What's in Maltesers?
There must be some, yeah. Once you have more than two saccharides, they make a polysaccharide. And these can be like very, very long chains. Mm. And polysaccharides are things like starch and cellulose, which makes up plant matter.
Mm-hmm. Isn't the one that we're going to talk about the most sucrose?
Yes.
So that's glucose and fructose.
That is like table sugar,
right? Yeah, so the sugar that's in front of us now is sucrose.
Yeah. What's interesting, though, is sugar, despite being thousands of years old, has only entered Western diets about 300 years ago in a serious way.
Mm.
But fats and salts and proteins, they're all ancient. We've been eating those for so many times. Actually, we're really just taking our first dose as a species of sugar.
It's massively skewed everything, really.
Which is possibly the reason for the obesity crisis. But even like simple carbohydrates like rice and wheat, that was only sort of 10,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Which in the context of a human species, like, is just like the last chapter.
So we're not meant to eat.
We're not meant to eat.
That's very clear. We're not meant to eat sugar.
And all of our taste buds have receptors for sweetness. It triggers endocannabinoids, which are the sort of happy chemicals that make us feel good and want more.
Do we know why it does that?
Well, we hypothesise that lactose, because lactose makes up 40% of breast milk, the babies that craved sugar consumed more calories as newborns and therefore more likely to survive in the early stages.
So we're all addicted to sugar, so we just never fully weaned.
Well, this is also the idea we love milk chocolate so much because it's got a very similar fat to sugar ratio as breast milk. We're like hardwired to crave these foods, like same with fat and salt. Basically, combinations you don't get very much in the wild of fat, salt, and sugar. That is very similar to breast milk.
They should make dairy milks in the shape of nipples to see if sales go up. So they make it even more like breast milk.
Hershey's kisses are quite nice.
That's true. Just on consumption, I was looking, the recommended annual consumption, I thought it was interesting to look at it annually because it's nearly always daily, but recommended annual consumption is about 11 kilograms a year.
Okay.
Under rationing in World War II, it was 9 to 12 kilograms. So when sugar was rationed, when society was told by the forced by the government to limit their sugar intake, we got it right. The amount we actually eat is kind of close to 16 to 20 kilograms, which is already over the 11 kilogram, but that's on a free sugars only basis. When you kind of try and account for how much sugar is just generally in the food supply, how much is added, you get closer to 30 kilograms.
Ooh.
Yeah.
In America, in 1961, which was at the peak of sugar consumption, 47 kilograms a year.
That's like almost
a person, it's almost your body weight.
Wow.
Isn't that
good.
Unbelievable?
It's, yeah. I eat a lot of sugar. I bake a lot.
I never run out of sugar.
Really?
I never put sugar in things. I just take all my sugar pre-processed. Well, like everything I have is in the sugar, you know.
There's that guy called Carlos Montero, the sort of founder of the idea of ultra-processed foods. He said he noticed, because he did a study in his native Brazil, and he noticed the people who had more sugar in their house actually had lower incidences of non-communicable disease like diabetes and heart attack. Mm-hmm.
But that's because all the people who have less sugar in their house, it's in them. They've eaten it.
Yes. Well, then it's true.
All the people with empty packets of sugar lying around.
Just like, basically, the theory is that like, if you've got sugar in the house, it's because you bake a lot. No. And if you're baking, you're making your own food. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you kind of know what's in it and you can control the proportions.
So
where
like...
people who didn't have sugar in the house weren't necessarily eating less sugar. They were just buying pre-made chocolate bars and stuff.
So ingredient household.
Yeah.
As a topic, it's quite like when we did salt, because they were like, oh, it's a food, but also it's like a basic chemical of life.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
Like it is such a massive, substantial contributor to human history and culture. And like obviously diet and how empires were formed and how history was shaped. And I would say it's almost like the oil of food. Like it's impacted culture and society so much.
So should we talk about where sugar comes from?
Well, how about where the word comes from, first of all?
Oh yeah.
I read that it's Sanskrit for gravel.
It is Sanskrit for gravel.
Exactly.
Yeah, but there are two different words. So one of them is kanda and the other one is sarkara.
Uh-huh.
And from each, we get sarkara gets saccharin and eventually sugar. And kanda leads to candy.
Nice.
They're sort of synonyms in Sanskrit for gravel or something gritty and granular.
Mm-hmm.
That surprises me then, because I thought that the gravel-like appearance of sugar is quite a fairly recent thing, and that we've been growing sugar cane to like feed animals and like how you get to that, from that to sugar. I'm just surprised that the name comes from like a gravelly, gritty thing. So have we been refining it for a long time?
Or for a really, really long time. So we've been growing it for ages. So sugar was first domesticated in New Guinea around 6000 BCE, but people were chewing it rather than turning it into the product that we have on the table.
So chewing gum was invented before sugar.
Chewing gum is, and now chewing gum's sugar-free. Actual resins, not even sugarcane. Really. Like gum is super old. And then it was first crystallized to make that grit in India around 500 BCE.
Oh, okay, so like 2,500 years, people were just chewing the cane, the grass.
And then someone had the great idea to cook it down, which is an incredibly complicated process.
Yeah.
So the two main types of sugar that we get now is sugarcane, which accounts for about 80% of the sugar that we have. And then the other is from sugar beet, which is a very, very sweet root vegetable. And the reason we use so much of that is because it's it makes sure that we've got like a diversified crop. Because when we got so hooked on sugar in Europe, we realized we should really figure out how to make this ourselves just in case anything happens. Mm. Chemically, they both produce sucrose and like they're the same. Although I've read some bakers can tell the difference.
No, I bet they're lying.
No, I call bullshit.
Yeah, I know, I was gonna say. Yeah, apparently they caramelize slightly differently.
Okay. I read that 50% of the UK sugar in supermarkets comes from domestic beet. So we make 50% of our sugar.
That's so cool.
Domestic beet's my DJ name. Okay, let's crack into our first lunchbox, and that is Manu.
I was silly excited about this one because I got to buy sugarcane.
Oh, cool.
So yeah, today I brought sugarcane. Looks like a bamboo.
Yeah, I've never seen it before, actually. I mean, I've seen it. I've never held one before.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's a big green cylindrical plant stem, and it's massive. And it's
dirty as well. Like, it's hard.
It's very solid. Mm-hmm. Manu was chopping it up early with a massive knife.
You looked very worried.
Well, I don't think we have liability insurance if you chop your hand off trying to cut the sugar.
My fingers are still there. I wanted to talk a little bit about how this becomes this jar of granulated sugar that's incredibly white and beautiful looking. So it's a grass, like bamboo.
Uh-huh.
It is weirdly high in sucrose, which is why it's the plant we decided to harvest and breed over generations to make it sweeter and sweeter and sweeter. So it's about 17% sucrose, which is insanely high.
Wow.
Would you like to try a bit?
Yeah.
Raw.
Would I?
So you can chew it. This was one of my favourite things whenever we used to go visit family in Zimbabwe, is like I'd always just get given a piece of sugar cane and I'd wander around like nom 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 all day.
It's so great.
These bits being sliced from the inside.
This is like the core of the cane.
Yeah, so this is just the inner bit of the cane. So you bite it and then you suck the juice out of it.
Ooh. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Not that sweet. Not as sweet as I was expecting.
Mm-hmm.
It tastes like melon.
No, it does. Very melony. Very fruity. Went to East Street Market to get this. And there's not that much sugar cane I bought. And the guy, I could tell he was trying me because he's told me how much one piece was and looked at me like, is she going to buy this? This is ridiculous.
How much was it?
A fiver. Oh. But you could tell in his face that just, it shouldn't cost a fiver.
Did he sweet talk you?
anyway, but it's really nice. I think people buy it like this to make into juices. Yeah. It would be really unusual if you made your own sugar at home. One of the reasons you wouldn't make this at home is because it is insanely labor intensive and it's a really, really, really complicated process.
Even though I saw it, it's quite prolifically, it grows about up to 5 centimeters a day. But when it's between 9 and 18 months old, that's when it's got the most sugar, so it's ripe for the harvest. Mm-hmm. And even better is when it starts to flower, that's when the sucrose content gets up to 17%.
So you've got your field of beautiful sugar cane and then you set it on fire.
What?
Yeah, I know.
Caramel.
No wonder sugar's so expensive. They keep burning it away.
So you set it on fire, and this is, I'm not sure if this is widespread anymore, but it's part of the history of processing to drive out pests.
Mm-hmm.
Sugarcane grows in tropical countries, so these pests are like, you really don't want to interact with them. It's like snakes. Yeah, snakes and stuff. So you drive out the pests. You also, it removes the outer leaves of the sugarcane, which can blunt your knives.
Oh, but the actual sugarcane is thick enough that it's fire resistant.
Yes, and it's quite liquidy inside. So your sugar cane is safe. You go in, you cut down your cane.
Oh, there's a word for that.
Ooh.
If you cut it down at the base, it's called ratooning.
Oh, nice.
You ratoon your cane.
You ratoon. That sounds really south, like deep south. Ratoon your cane.
That's what they do with the massive machetes, right?
Yeah, it's big. You take it to the factory, you wash it, you crush it, and then you mill it, which is like even more intense crushing.
And then you bop it. And
crack it. I didn't play bop it. Twist it.
Ratoon that all on the floor.
And then you basically juice all of the mush you've created.
Okay. Which we just did in our mouths.
Yes. Okay. And then you can use this waste pulp, which is called bagasse, to make...
Big ass.
Big ass. It's B-A-G... A double S.
Oh, bag ass.
Bag ass.
I was going to say, because sugar ironically gives you a big ass.
It's, oh, God. And then you can make these.
Oh.
So a lot of the disposable cutlery and plates that we have is made out of mushed up sugar cane.
Manny's just brought a whole pile of... You could have just brought one. We've got 100 plates here.
I actually couldn't buy a single one. I did try, but it's that material that's like...
It's kind of plasticky, kind of woody. It's sort of the material that egg boxes are made from, but a bit
less fluffy.
You can also make egg boxes. You can make...
A lot of packaging comes like this now. Like if you order electricals, there'll be a lot of brown, like kind of... It's sort of cardboardy, but quite fibrous. Is that all from sugarcane?
Yeah,
because
it's... But
I don't taste sweet.
I don't know if it's edible, but you are finding out, and I commend you for that.
Yeah.
So that's what you've got with the mush, the bagasse. And then the juice goes through... So many processes.
Really?
I will not bore you with all of them, but one of them is not pretty. It's basically like pouring the juice through a sulfur dioxide vapor to bleach it. It's a lot of like intense chemical processes, intense heating. And what you end up with is like a really kind of pure juice and then molasses, which is the darker liquid, which we use to make lots of other products, lots of other sugars.
It's like rum.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you can distill it.
This bit of the process I thought interesting is that some refined white cane sugar, to decolorize it, you process it using bone char, which is like the burnt bones of animals.
Yeah.
Ooh.
And so actually your white cane sugar might not all be
might
vegan.
Not be vegan.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
To add to our Nothing is Vegan series.
Oh, damn it.
You could kill two birds with one fire, couldn't you? Burn some animals in your
chair. Yeah, I've got to imagine you're a poor bird who escapes the sugar fuel fire. And then
get caught to be turned into bone char.
Wait, so is there any bone char left in the sugar after it's been
fermented? No, it doesn't stay in there. It's just used as a tool in the refining process. But I think because it's just a tool and it's certainly not in there, it means it's harder to kind of track if you're trying to work out what's vegan and what's not. Yeah. Because if that sugar is one ingredient in something that you eat that is then labelled as vegan, it's really hard to tell. But
an animal probably did die.
Yeah. Sorry, guys.
I mean, it's going to get worse before it gets better.
Beet sugar doesn't do this process, so that's a good one to go for. If you want to be absolutely sure that no animals were involved.
So then we have the molasses, and we also have the really pure juice, and that's heated and heated and heated and heated until it crystallizes, and that's when we get our, like...
white gold.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, that's the bare bones process.
That's so insensitive to the animals who died.
Oh god.
I know, be careful with the language.
Okay, so one person in the history of sugarcane who is really cool is a woman called Janaki Amal, and she's an Indian botanist who actually made sugarcane sweeter.
Oh.
So
where did she live?
Her dates are 1897 to 1984. She was born in Kerala, born into a well-to-do family, but they were low caste, so there wasn't like a crazy amount of pressure on her to marry super well, but instead the family put a lot of pressure on her education, which was fantastic because she obviously loved it. Enormous nerd, this woman. While she was working in the Women's Christian College in Madras, she got a scholarship to the University of Michigan, where she studied botany, and then she became the first female doctor of botany in the US ever.
No way.
Wow.
And then she went back to India and she started working at the sugarcane breeding station. And what she did was studied lots of different grasses and made a sugarcane that was better suited to growing in India, because at the time they were having like quite a lot of production issues. They were having to import a lot. Okay. And what she did was create a sugarcane that not only kind of stopped the need to import other sugars because it was doing so well, actually turned India into the second biggest producer of sugarcane in the world, which it still is today.
Wow.
So she's like big sugar
lady.
Add
her to our pantheon of people who changed the food world.
I know.
Like the little boy who worked out how to pollinate vanilla. Yeah.
Anyway, so she eventually leaves India. She moves to the UK and she becomes the first female ever to work as a botanist at the Royal Horticultural Society.
I feel like she was living in a time where whatever she did, she was the first one to do it. I don't want to like minimise her achievements. No.
And then in the 50s, she's literally summoned by the Prime Minister Nehru to come back to India to kind of restructure their botanical survey. And in her 80s, she was awarded the Padma Shri, which is one of the highest civilian honours you can earn in India. So yeah.
What a legend.
Apparently quite eccentric. Like she carried around a squirrel and had like a teddy bear and stuff.
I like her even more.
Yeah, no, really, really cool lady.
So how did we get to this industrialized process of how we make sugar? What is the history of domesticating the sugar to the world making it?
There's a long story. So there's a man called Dioscorides, who's a first century travel writer, basically, and he went east to what is now Pakistan and talked about a kind of concreted honey called saccharon, found in reeds in India and Arabia Felix, which has the appearance of salt and is like that brittle.
Well, that's funny because the Greeks and the Romans described it kind of similarly, I think probably around 300 BC. Mm-hmm. One of Alexander the Great's generals described it as a reed in India that brings forth honey without the help of bees. So I guess the only thing they had for comparison that was sweet was honey.
Honey, So from India, where we discovered it was first sort of turned into the grains that we all recognized, it slowly spread westwards and eventually would conquer the whole world because it's so damn popular. And then as sugar travels through the Silk Roads, friend of the podcast, basically everything in the world gets globalized by either the Columbian Exchange or the Silk Roads. Anyway, the first place it then went to and was domesticated and grown was the Middle East, between 500 and 1000 Common Era, because it's hot enough. Trouble is, it really needs water. And the Middle East isn't not as rich in water as the tropics are, which is where sugar is naturally found. So what they had to do was basically irrigate the shit out of parts of the Middle East. There's a quote from Andrew Watson of the University of Toronto, who wrote a book called Agricultural Innovation in the Early Islamic World. He said, There's hardly a river, stream, oasis, spring, known aquifer or predictable flood that wasn't unused, basically just to irrigate this water to get it to the sugarcane fields. But it is quite hard to measure the amounts from a long, long time ago because it doesn't leave any archaeological trace because basically microbes like to chomp on it. Mm-hmm. So there's very little sugar left over. But it was used quite medicinally at the time. I found one recipe involved mixing it with gold powder and then blowing it in someone's face to try and help cure their eye problems. No accounts of whether it worked or not. Mm-hmm. And then by 1000 CE, the Kingdom of Venice took over the Mediterranean market and they started growing it in places like Sicily and Crete and Cyprus.
Do these places all still grow sugar?
Well, they did, or they could. Basically, it's not commercially viable. And in fact, this is where the sort of enslavery process starts to happen, is under the Venetians, because you need a lot of a workforce. It's a very labor-intensive crop.
Super labor-intensive.
And it's also quite wood-intensive because you need to keep fires burning to boil this sugar mass away. And so these early enslaved people were probably from Turkey, Bulgaria, and the Caucasus, Arabia. They were under Venetian control. And then around 1200, the Ottomans take over. Mm-hmm. So basically, European sugar trade starts to slow down because the Ottomans don't want to give it to the Europeans. So then they start looking westwards. Christopher Columbus, you've heard of him.
I cannot with this man. He will not stop.
He sailed west from Spain to an island which was growing sugar.
Madeira.
Yeah. So basically, the Portuguese colony of Madeira is a tiny little island off the coast of Africa, almost like a third of the way across the Atlantic. But the clever Portuguese had realized you could grow sugarcane on Madeira. Mm. And Christopher Columbus was basically trading sugar before he discovered the New World. Mm-hmm. Basically, the European sugar trade wound down because it was getting too expensive and the Ottomans wouldn't share.
They were literally burning Europe down. And it was mad. The deforestation because of sugar. Didn't Madeira lose like all of its trees?
Yeah. Anyway, so they were basically seeking elsewhere to start growing their sugar. And then with the discovery of basically America, they were like, great, a chance to grow more sugarcane.
Mm-hmm. So obviously you can't talk about sugar without talking about the slave trade because this is one of the things that drove it. Sugar was one of, actually, I think it was the biggest thing that enslaved people were being used to make. People think of cotton in America, but it was actually sugar.
I read that the ratio of slaves employed to sugar production was 10 times that of other plantation crops, like tobacco and cotton. You needed way more people. 3/4 of all enslaved people out of Africa were destined for sugar plantations. Mm-hmm. But at this point, I think the Mediterranean's sugar industry still on its last legs, but what really killed it off was Brazil, because there was so much wood to keep the boilers going. And the Portuguese also had the island colony of Sao Tome, which was used as basically a marketplace for enslaved people. And Brazil's sugar production was greater than that of the rest of the Atlantic combined in 1600.
Wow.
Still the biggest producer of sugar today, isn't it?
Yeah.
I read that by the 1700s, sugar was the most important traded commodity internationally, and it was responsible for a third of the whole European economy. Which is unbelievable. And so what about where sugar beet came from?
I know part of the reason why it's so big is that the British threatened the French sugar cane.
In the early 19th century, there was a big naval blockade and France basically couldn't get its sugar from anywhere. Mm-hmm. This was under Napoleon.
Napoleon Bonaparte. And so I want my sugar.
He did exactly what he did all the time, which is basically offer a large sum of money to his cabal of geniuses fix his food problem. So he started giving out million franc incentives to farmers to develop this. And so the reason we have a European sugar industry is down to Napoleon.
Thank you, Napoleon.
Merci. Yeah.
Okay, let's move on to our second lunchbox, and that is Jack's.
So I've brought you 5 lunchboxes.
Ooh.
So Manu's talked about how we go from nature to what we find on our supermarket shelves. Mm-hmm. I wanted to delve a bit more into different varieties of things you find on the supermarket shelves, because even in the common supermarkets, you get brown sugar and white sugar, right? I wondered what the difference was. Mm. White sugar is basically the rawest, most chemically basic form of sucrose that we have. Sugar is only white because we process it to high heaven.
Yeah, not all sugar is white.
Yeah, exactly.
Not hashtag not all sugar. I mean, like, as in, I don't want to turn this into a race thing.
So anyway, sugar is naturally quite brown, even once you've processed it enough to get the grains out. So when you make white sugar, you centrifuge the molasses out.
And by centrifuge, you mean spun around and around so that the heavier stuff stays in the center and the lighter stuff gets thrown on the outside.
In fact, a lot of brown sugar, you add molasses back in to make it brown, which seems so counterintuitive.
So hang on a second. So when they're processing it, they take the molasses out. And then if you want brown sugar, they put the molasses back in.
Often, yeah. I think it's just more commercially viable that way.
But also you can control the flavour of the sugar. So it's like, how rich do I want this? How deep?
And so the amount of molasses and the amount by which it's been ground are kind of the two variables for different types of sugar.
Basically, I wanted to do a sugar taste test because people think that sugar is just sweet. And that's not really true. Sugar is as individual as wine. Some argue. Anyway, so I've brought you, from right to left, turbinado sugar, basically partially processed so that it's still got some of the molasses in.
Large chunks, it's brown, it's quite gravelly, sandy, almost like rice.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the second one in is coconut. So coconut sugar comes from the sap of a coconut plant.
Oh, nice.
Wow.
So that's not come from sugarcane.
That's cool. And that looks like fine brown dirt.
It looks like fine
brown dirt. Can you do that, make sugars with different plant saps?
Yeah. I read about dibs, which is the plant sap from the date palm.
Oh, nice.
You can make sugar from dates. Because a lot of fruit obviously naturally has sugar in. And then the middle one there, which actually, that looks very gravelly.
This is reminding me of going to the Museum of Edinburgh.
I was going
to
say, that looks exactly like the dirt that we ate.
It's just dirt, it's just gravel. Okay.
So that's panela, which is from Colombia.
Right.
And that is also non-centrifugal brown sugar, which is jaggery.
Oh.
And that is in a very different form.
It's like fudge.
Because it's in cake form. It's basically like a solid block. I've shaved a couple of slices off. And yeah, like you say, it looks like fudge. And then finally, we have in liquid form, maltose.
Oh my gosh, now so that just looks like honey.
So it looks like honey, but if you notice, I'm lifting the spoon up. Whoa. It's got a much... When you lift up a honey spoon, you get a strand, like a cheese strand, and it will break off quite easily. But this is going a lot further before it breaks. So it makes for a very beautiful, like, gloopy sugar.
It's giving PVA glue.
Anyway, would you like to... I've got the panela.
Oh, yeah. Interesting. That's very smoky, that one.
Yeah. I think that's very raisiny.
Yeah, very, very kind of fruity. Yeah. I'm going to try the
maltose. Maltose comes mostly from China because before they discovered sugarcane, they discovered a sweetener made from sorghum and rice. And basically, if you process grain in the right way, it can make a sweet, sugary liquid. But it's actually got less sweetness to it. So I don't know if you noticed when you tried.
Okay. The coconut one is fantastic.
Really?
Like, it's so Moorish and a bit malty. Like, I would eat a lot of that.
Mm.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the coconut one's really nice. Good. Why do I not know about that? Why is that not more common?
It's so good.
I guess it's hard to process. Because
you don't really eat it raw, usually, do you?
Oh, you can't really scale it up.
Well, I guess this is when you said that all sugar is not the same. When we think about, like, the sugar that we eat, the sucrosey stuff that's made from cane and beet, that is chemically the same. One of the reasons it's such a useful ingredient is because, like salt, it doesn't really have any other flavour to it apart from sweet, whereas all of these have, like, a beautiful array of flavours that the molasses gives or whatever's in the maltose.
The impurities, yeah.
There's not often there's foods that is such a blank canvas and you can add to so many different things, which people do. That's why there's sugar in so much of our food. And it doesn't affect the flavour apart from adding, like, that one specific element.
I do think there is a case for heritage varieties and different processing and the terroir of sugar.
Love terroir.
I love it. That's my friend of the podcast. So I want to talk also a bit about Hawaii, because we said that earlier that sugar went from east to west, but some of it... It went the other way around the world. So sugar cane was one of the things that the Polynesians took with them when they explored the Pacific and discovered Hawaii.
Oh.
So we're talking 8,000 BCE. Sugar arrived in Hawaii with the Polynesians. Unfortunately, by modern days, it's been sort of heavily monocultured because commercially viable to make something that is grows fast, is cheap to produce, and makes a consistent product. But in the intervening 8,000 to 10,000 years, there were lots of different varieties of sugarcane that have become extinct. But I read about a guy called Noah Kekuewa Lincoln. He's a man who's an expert in indigenous cropping systems, and he wanted to sort of untangle this monoculture. So he went about it in quite an anthropological way, I thought. He read lots of old press cuttings. Mm-hmm. He talked to old people, and he analysed language and songs for clues about these different varieties.
That's cool.
Which I think is really cool. There's one song from the Ni'ihau Island. My love returns to Ni'ihau, to hidden waters of the pa'au fish, to the breadfruit that blossoms on the flats, the sugarcane of Halali'i dug out by hand. So it gives a location, which is Ni'ihau. Mm-hmm. It gives a name for the cane variety, Halai'i, mm-hmm. And a tip on tending the plant, dug out by hand,
yeah.
And its proximity to breadfruit. And all these little clues meant that he went sort of Indiana Jones style and like found examples of these sugar canes.
That's amazing.
That's so cool.
Yeah, he's found about 80 varieties by name, but a lot of them haven't been matched up to existing ones because they've gone extinct. Mm. But there's another one that was translated as Dew from the North, which he then realised when he came across a sugar cane in Kona, mm-hmm. which is on the west of the Big Island, which casts shadows on the north side of its stems, which preserves the dew, keeps the moisture.
Ah.
And he found that by talking to an old person. I can't remember.
What I'm getting from this is talk to old people.
Yeah, basically,
sometimes.
Yeah. But also, and then on the etymology.
The most boring work often yields the best results.
And then a lot of sugarcane varieties actually share names with local fish. So the black sturgeon fish and the flagtail tile fish are two examples local to Hawaii. And they're known respectively as Maikoiko and Maka'a. And the former is a deep dark purple, which matches the cane of the same name, which is also deep dark purple. And then the latter, Maka'a, means glowing eye. And guess what? Both the fish and the sugarcane have a little eye pattern on them.
Wow.
So yeah, it's just an amazing sort of way around. And actually the song I mentioned, Halali'i, means little hala tree. Mm-hmm. The hala tree is all over the islands of Hawaii. And sure enough, it grows in windy places where the sand builds up and covers the base. Because as we said, sugar cane's like a long, thin pole. Mm. And if you can just see the top, it looks like a little hala tree.
Aww.
That's amazing. All that kind of cultural.
Yeah, it's a bit like preserving languages. It's all sort of people want to hold on to cultures before they disappear from the record. But he also has a vested interest because he makes rum. But he's making rum out of these single origin cane species. And he says you wouldn't dream of drinking a wine and not knowing what grape it came from. And so he wants to sort of apply that to rums.
That's
and
nice. I like that.
It's going to be so good for his marketing as well. Like,
looking at all these different types of sugars, I presume all of these came in bags?
Yes.
They did. But that was not always the case, that sugar was sold in bags. Mm-hmm. It used to be sold in loaves. You used to go out by a loaf of sugar.
Oh, a sugar loaf.
A comical loaf of sugar.
The sugar loaf.
Should we talk about sugar... what is it? Presentation, transportation, packaging.
Okay.
I feel like maybe the generation before us are more familiar with sugar coming in cubes, but it's kind of a rarity these
days. Dying out, isn't it? Although I read that the Domino brand, which you can find in America, not actually cubes. Someone measured them. They were 12.5 millimeters by 12.5 millimeters by 13 millimeters.
I've noticed that a lot of sugar cubes are not cubes, they're cuboids. But before cubes were a thing, sugar used to be sold in loaves.
Ooh.
In conical loaves. They were of sort of rounded top cone shape. The earliest records for these date back all the way to 12th century Jordan, in fact. I think in Europe we got them for about 1470. They kind of reached England around 1544. They varied considerably in size. So the bigger the loaf, the lower the quality of sugar.
Okay.
So in the 15th century, a loaf could be about 14 inches in diameter at the base and 3 feet tall.
Oh my gosh.
That's massive.
It's a lot of sugar to put in, like, as far as your shopping basket goes. Yeah. And weigh about 30 pounds.
How are you moving these things about? Were you just like, hoiking them off
you
the floor?
You get your servant
like
to do it.
I think that's what thing. That's what the seat at the front of the trolley is for. It's actually not for babies. So the way that conical loaves came about is down to how sugar was refined. You have your brown sugar and you want to make it whiter. And one of the ways of doing that was applying a sort of white clay solution to the dissolved loaf, and you pour it in at the dissolved end, and then it would slowly drain through and carry off all the molasses, and presumably also kind of dye it white, I guess. So
like we mentioned in the lamb episode, a doner kebab.
I was thinking that. It's so similar to a doner kebab shape, and it turns out that the same reason. And then they would drain that, dry it, and wrap it. Often they'd wrap it in blue paper because that made the white stand out more, so it looks really nice and pure. And then a lot of households would buy those, and you might buy quite big ones if you were a big household. So you'd probably have that in your larder or storeroom. And then there were various implements that existed, and Tim Hayward would love this, to break it down. So there were little sugar axes, little axes for smashing through your sugar, and sugar hammers, and sugar nips, sugar choppers, sugar scrapers. Used the sort of the axe and the hammers to break through the hardened outer layer of the sugar, so you could get into the inside.
So it had like a casing.
The sugar nips are this, like, they're like a pair of pincers, kind of like scissors, but they've got two sort of spades on the end of each. So they sort of extracted a lump out of the
Clever.
The whole conical thing. So that's sort of where the first sugar lumps came from.
That's fascinating, Alex, but please don't call me sugar nips ever again.
You can call me sugar nips, that's fine.
Okay, time for our third and final lunchbox, and that is mine. And I am going to make you a cup of coffee in the style of 19th century Danish philosopher Søren Kierkegaard.
Exciting.
I have my cafetière here of black coffee. This is what he did. He would fill his mug up to the brim with sugar.
Oh, my God. Oh, no.
Piled, like a pile of, over the rim. And then slowly pour the coffee onto that, dissolving the sugar.
Oh my god.
Saturation,
it's bubbling
point.
Ominously.
Ooh.
It's coming out like treacle.
I bet that tastes good.
Would you want to try it? It's decaf, so.
Ah, thank you for a buzz.
Yeah, so that.
Yummy. Okay.
What a lunatic!
You get a lot done in your day.
You wouldn't have very many days though. He lived, I think, 1813 to 1855.
42.
I would say that had something to do with it. I wanted to talk today about the health impact of sugar.
Yes.
And also dispel some sugar misconceptions and myths.
Okay.
So we all know that sugar is not very good for us, certainly not in the quantities that we have it today. And that actually sort of has its roots all the way back in the 1950s, when heart disease was killing a lot of American men. And part of the national conversation in the medical community was, how do we stop this? What's causing it?
Didn't Eisenhower have a heart attack, and instead of keeping it secret, he sort of admitted it to the American public?
Really?
And that sort of popularized the idea that Americans were eating too much cholesterol.
Anyway, the medical world was sort of split on what was causing heart disease, whether it was, on the one hand, fat and cholesterol, or on the other hand, sugar. And for a while, a lot of people were saying, oh, it's fat and cholesterol. So the sugar industry was pretty relaxed because business is good for them. That's fine. But then people started wondering and talking about whether maybe sugar had something to do with this. And this made the sugar industry nervous. Institutions such as the Sugar Research Foundation, there's an internal memo in 1964 that proposed they fund some research to refute their detractors. All they care about is making money. It was in their interest for everyone to believe that fat and cholesterol was the sole cause of like heart-based diseases, so that they wouldn't worry about sugar. And they found a scientist at Harvard called Mark Hedstead, he already believed that saturated fat caused heart disease, although actually part of the reason he believed that was because the dairy industry had funded some previous research. Anyway.
Science is so political.
He also did, I think he was a legitimate scientist, scientist as well.
Yeah.
And so the Sugar Research Foundation paid Hegstead to review some papers that said that sugar was to blame, okay, and sort of tear them apart and say, this is rubbish. It's actually fats and saturated.
You put this comma in the wrong place.
Yeah.
You're referencing Zormet. Yeah.
That kind of thing, exactly.
Yeah, you spelt hemoglobin wrong.
Yeah. But the resulting review ran in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1967. Mm. And it concluded that there was no doubt that it was only reducing fat that could prevent heart disease. It was never disclosed that the foundation paid for this review. And in those days as well, like, I think one or two well-placed reviews in a couple of magazines can really turn the tide in mainstream scientific conversation.
Well, it was like the dad of PR.
With the breakfast.
Getting the doctors.
Freud, wasn't it?
Paying doctors to put this in newspapers, and then everyone fell for it.
Anyway, the consequence was that everyone started sort of getting behind this idea, and by 1980, official dietary guidelines were telling Americans to cut fat. And what happens is that manufacturers have to cut fat because all the consumers are looking for reduced fat products. Mm. And they replace it with sugar and refined starches so that it will still taste just as nice.
Because you need the same calories, but you, like, naturally, your body's looking for homeostasis. So
it really was a war between, like, the fat industry and the sugar industry, because, like, you're going to have one or the other in all your products. So calorie intake rose and obesity rates climbed because there was so much sugar in everything. And decades later, there was a researcher called Kristin Kearns who found this paper trail. Kristin Kearns was writing a story about dentistry and teeth in all, like, archived correspondence and published it in 2016. There were historians and other people who pushed back and basically said, well, actually, fair enough, like, the sugar industry were pushing, but also the fat and cholesterol and the dairy industry were pushing the other side. And, like, it's kind of so it's kind of damning on the food industry and like medical complex
and politics and stuff.
But it's astonishing that really you can trace in some ways all the sugar in all our food, especially in America. You can trace back to basically a few years where the sugar industry were a bit worried and decided to push it.
That's amazing.
Anyway, this got me thinking about legal wranglings and loopholes in the sugar industry, and it reminded me of the Tic Tac phenomenon.
Oh yeah, I know this fact.
Such a good sound.
This is the best. Okay, so this is a packet of Tic Tacs. Now, in the UK, they're not labelled as sugar-free, but in the US, they are. And yet they're made almost entirely of sugar.
Okay. America, explain yourself.
It's kind of a genius legal loophole. So basically, in the US, the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, allows products that have less than 0.5 grams of sugar per serving, because that's such a tiny amount, they're allowed to label themselves as 0 grams of sugar, sugar-free.
Right?
Because like in a serving, it's negligible. If you eat a bowl of cereal and it's got 0.5 grams of sugar, fair enough. Tic Tacs are 94% sugar. But they weigh only 0.49 grams each. So they're just just under. And Tic Tac say that the recommended serving is one Tic Tac, which
Excuse me, obviously is bullshit. Who's eating one Tic Tac?
So it means that they're allowed to say there's no sugar in a Tic Tac because you're allowed to round it down to zero, basically.
Is it bad? My first reaction to that was like, that's such a good idea. No one uses.
It's like salami slicing. There's like a type of financial fraud where you just take, like, instead of taking £1 million from someone's account, they'll definitely notice.
You take one pound a million times.
It's known as salami slicing. If you have a log of salami and you cut a slice off, no one will notice the difference, right?
But I do think that is also a really big problem in food generally. Like, like the serving suggestions are usually just such nonsense. They're like, serves 8 and it's like 5 Maltesers.
Giving sugar to children. Do we think sugar makes kids hyper?
Yes.
The trope of sugar making kids hyperactive is massively blown out of proportion. There's actually no studies that have been able to show that sugar makes kids hyperactive. So it's basically in the 1970s, there was a pediatric allergist called Benjamin Feingold. So he was studying how different foods affected kids with ADHD. And he conducted a study that found 75% of the kids who had a reduced sugar intake showed like way better concentration, all of these amazing health benefits. But his study was so poorly conducted. There was like basically no control group. It was all really wishy-washy. And every study that's tried to replicate his results since have found that it's more like less than 2% actually kind of showed the same boosts in concentration and all of these amazing benefits.
But how does this terrible science get through? Like, if he did a really poor experiment, then like, why didn't it get peer reviewed? I don't understand this.
It's the 70s.
I saw a study that showed it, but it was quite clever. It basically told parents who had come to pick up their children from daycare, I think it was quite a scientifically controlled daycare, that they'd given them sugar. Half of them they'd given them sugar and half of them they hadn't. But actually they'd given none of them sugar. And then the parents reported hyperactive behaviour in the ones that thought they'd had sugar.
Yeah.
And so it's actually just we look for the patterns that we expect to see.
Yeah, it's confirmation bias. Yeah.
There's one thing they think it might be, eating lots of sugar can give you a dopamine kick. And the dopamine kick actually might lead to hyperactivity. So there's something about being in an environment, say like if you're at a birthday party, you're given sugar. It's all very exciting anyway.
That makes way more sense that you're given sugar in environments where it's exciting anyway.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And
you didn't get chocolate in the library because you're not allowed to get over the books.
And also if it was also blood sugar, you'd get hyperactive off a potato.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, sugar also famously is very bad for your teeth. And in Tudor England, sugar was obviously very expensive, as we discussed earlier.
Oh, yes.
And only wealthy people could afford to eat so much that it would rot their teeth. Queen Elizabeth I famously had very blackened teeth. There are multiple accounts of her having blackened teeth because she ate so much sugar. She loved sugar.
Yeah.
And there's also accounts of her stuffing her cheeks with cloth to fill the kind of gaunt...
Oh, no, because she lost Gordon, teeth.
She lost teeth inside her head.
That's very, who's the Godfather?
Oh yeah, Marlon Brando.
Yeah. Still so skeptical when we hear about historical accounts of like people not washing and not brushing their teeth. Like,
I can imagine people like the amount that dentists make you do now with intradental flossing and stuff. They just didn't have that technology back then in terms of like really removing bacteria. Mm-hmm. And the other big difference as well is fluoride. They didn't have fluoride in their teeth.
Fair.
What's really interesting is there were studies of skeletons from Pompeii and Herculaneum.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
yeah. We always come on Pompeii in this podcast because there's always so much food evidence.
Yeah.
But they have surprisingly good dental health, and they think it's a combination of the low sugar diet, because honey was the primary sweetener in that area, lots of bees, but also there's a high natural fluoride content of the drinking water.
No way.
Because of the volcanic geology, famously around Pompeii.
Huge factor. I've heard that people like intentionally blackened their teeth to make it look like they were rich enough to afford sugar, and therefore they were
I looked it up. I couldn't actually find evidence that people did it. I think that's an exaggeration. I think it's probably true that blackened teeth at certain points in history were associated with wealth in the upper classes because they were the people who were able to avoid sugar. But I don't think that anyone actually went to the point of blackening their teeth to look richer. There's one example in Japan. There's something called ohaguro, which is the blackening of teeth as a cosmetic practice. But that's because white teeth were seen as animalistic and black was civilized and elegant. It's a whole different reason. On the other side of sugar being really bad for you, sugar being used in a healthy way. And we mentioned in the intro that you can use sugar in beekeeping.
Oh, yeah.
So powdered sugar, if you dust your bees in powdered sugar, you know, like at the end of a cake when you just kind of, you know, garnish.
With a sieve.
Yeah, sieve, exactly. Some beekeepers use this to protect bees against varroa mites. Apparently because the sugar encourages the bees to groom each other, which physically dislodges the mites.
Sweet.
Its effectiveness is debated. I think it probably helps. It's not necessarily like a completely amazing cure, but I kind of make sense to me, the logic.
When kids get head lice, you should just cover them in sugar.
Yeah.
They'll lick each other's heads. Yeah.
That's such a good idea.
Another use for sugar, apparently it's used as a concrete retarder.
What's a concrete retarder?
So it basically slows down the setting of concrete. So you can control by adding, you know, different amounts of sugar to concrete, it'll set at a different pace. And actually, there's one example in 2014 in central London. Some builders had a cement leak and it leaked into a signalling station on the Victoria line. And they obviously closed the Victoria line. But one of the first things they did was rush to all the supermarkets and buy up all of the sugar they could and poured it into the cement to stop it setting so they could sweep it up quicker.
So clever.
Because if it set, there'd be even more chaos. You'd have to chip it away.
So does that mean there's parts of the Victoria line that taste delicious?
Yeah,
we should start licking the walls.
Yeah.
Okay, that is it for this week's edition of Lunchbox Envy and part one of the sugar episode. We will be back with part two.
Another sprinkling.
You can follow our socials for foodie facts and podcast updates. We are on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram and TikTok at Lunchbox Envy Pod.
You can also get in touch and send us your facts, recipes and questions by emailing us lunchbox@qi.com.
Before we go, I've been seeing another podcast.
Oh my god.
Yes, it's called Here's What You Do. It's a really fun quiz podcast hosted by professional quiz writers, James Smales, Johnny Robbins and John Cantrell, who are, in fact, James used to work on QI years ago.
Yeah.
So each episode they do a quiz, but they make up a quiz format each week, like different quiz formats.
It's amazing,
really fun.
how their brains exactly. work. I love it. It's a really entertaining quiz.
So you can listen to my episode now, which is out this week, and I'll stick a clip of the episode at the end of this episode as well.
Yeah, have a little listen.
We will see you next week. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Lunchbox Envy was hosted by Jack Chambers, Manu Onryo, and produced by me, Alex Bell. This has been a quite interesting podcast. Going to give you five things that all sound like foodstuffs, but only one of them is actually a foodstuff.
Oh, nice.
So it's basically odd one out, but it's odd one in.
Yeah.
Okay, which of these is the real foodstuff? Mint police, bread crust bomb, salty brine, pork adobo, muffin top. You get 2 points for identifying the correct foodstuff, but a point for every correct thing you can identify beyond that. I don't think you'll get many of them because a lot of them are quite niche.
Well, I think I know number five.
Yeah, number five I feel pretty confident with. Is it mint police?
Yep.
Brilliant. Okay.
As in, stop, mint police. I don't know. I don't know how to demonstrate context.
What's the pork one? Pork adoro.
Pork adobo. A-D-O-B-O.
A-D-O-B-O. It is pork adobo.
I'm clipping that up, Johnny, and using that as a buzzer at some point.
That's actually the theme tune to this quiz now, yeah. This round. It doesn't have a title, but it has a song. James, what have you gone for?
Well, I think the food is salty brine. That feels like a food.
John, how about you?
I've gone for pork adobo.
And Johnny?
Same. Pork adobo.
Well, you are both right. It is pork adobo. It is. Whoa. That pork adobo is a Filipino curry made with pineapple and dark soy.
Lovely.
Ah.
Would you like to find out what the rest of the things were?
Yes, please.
I said that pork adobo was an instrument. It sounded a bit like an oboe. So I was like, oh, the pork adobo.
It does sound like an instrument, yeah. So the mint police, any guesses?
No idea.
The mint police is a police force designated to the US Mint. They police like money fraud and stuff. Very good, yeah, very they good. Are literally the mint police. A bread crust bomb, any guesses?
Not a clue, no.
I said a band.
No, it would be a good band name. And I can't guarantee it's not a band, actually, but it's called ejected tephra. It's a type of lava bomb that comes out of a volcano that has, it's like kind of liquid. It's like a mozzarella ball, I guess. It has a bristle outer shell and it's soft and molten on the inside. And so when it lands, it gets blown out of the volcano. When it lands, it explodes.
Delicious.
Gosh, we're learning loads, eh?
Salty brine?
I thought it's like you just like stick a bit of pork in and leave it there for a few hours.
It is that, I suppose it is. It's also the name of an American broadcaster. He was called Walter Brine. He lived from 1918 to 2004 and he was called Salty Brine.
Love it.
That's an incredible name.
And muffin top? I imagine some of you got that.
We've all got it, Alex.
Yeah. the area that sticks out above your trousers.
Just above your jeans, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, great. Well, you all get one. So hang on a second. That's 2 points for John and Johnny, and then a one extra for all of you.